Philip Glass joins me now. The Metropolitan Opera has recently revived his Satyagraha to rave reviews. The opera, which was originally staged at the Met in 2008, examines the philosophy of Mahatma Gandhi and the development of his revolutionary ideas of nonviolence during his time in South Africa. It's currently playing through December 1st, and I'm pleased to welcome Philip Glass back to our show today. It's always a pleasure to have you
here.
Thank
you, Lynn. I'm always happy to be here.
Why did you choose Gandhi's experience in South Africa as the basis for an opera?
Well, I got interested in Gandhi when I was visiting India numerous times in the 60s, and I became aware of his life. And when I began to think about doing an opera, I wanted to go back to the roots of it. I wanted to go back to the beginning, and the beginning for him happened to be there.
And you were in India because of your association with Ravi Shankar?
Partly it was that, and also my general interest in Indian culture had come to a head in a certain way. I had been living in Paris. And I knew that when I got back, this was 66, that when I got back to New York, my life would change in a way that might make it impossible for me to return to India quickly. And I was, at that time, Joan Acolytis and I were married, and we decided to make an overland trip to India. And it was a very wonderful thing to have done.
Well, this is the second in a trilogy of operas about important historical figures.
Yes.
Should I see some kind of link between the three? We had
Einstein
on the beach in 1976. Akhenaten in 1983, and then this one.
Yeah, this is as Leonard, you know me, I'm nothing if not over ambitious. So what I decided was the piece began with Bob Wilson, but then when I began thinking about Gandhi, then I immediately thought that Einstein would be the scientist, Akhenaten would be the man of religion.
Because he was a monotheist pharaoh.
And then that made Gandhi the man of politics. So I had science, politics, and religion, which are three of the great these are the things that form our lives. But the point was...
So what's next, a philosopher? Are you going to do Aristotle, Nietzsche?
I didn't do that. I did end up recently doing Kepler, which was really a lot of fun. But the point of that was that I wanted to pick people who had changed the course of the world through nonviolence. Now, and it came about in this way. I was with my little kids that are now in their 40s. I was driving up that expressway that goes out up to New York State.
The New York Thruway.
No. I couldn't remember.
Taconic or one of those.
And I was wondering, why was it named that?
Mm-hmm.
And the Major Deacon Expressway. And my little boy at the time said to me, "Daddy, who was Major Deacon?" Well, I had no idea. So I decided to find out. And I found out that Major Deacon had run a munitions dump for Mayor LaGuardia. He was just a pal of his. And because he was his friend, he got a highway named after him. And he was somehow in the army. And then it occurred to me that why do we name our airports and our highways after people who a generation later no one even knows who they are? I bet you right now you ask people under 40 what JFK stood for and they couldn't tell you. Okay, the point is that why not have a Jackson Pollock freeway? Mm-hmm. The Europeans are better at that than we are. We certainly aren't very good at that. But then, so then I thought, who are these people that I'm interested in that changed the world because they changed the culture of the world and they changed it through ideas.
Although the Europeans sometimes do weird things. In Paris, one of the train stations, the metro stations, is Stalingrad. I don't think anybody would name anything that now.
No, and they haven't changed the name. But these names eventually do get changed. But we name politicians and generals who are we remember a culture because of the artists and the philosophers and the scientists and the poetry and the food and all kinds of things. But never maybe Bonaparte, a few here and there. But very few. Very few people know who MacArthur is these days.
And do you think that many of the people who go to see this opera are aware that Gandhi spent so much time in South Africa?
It might be a surprise, and yet it's not a trick. He spent 20 years there. It was because he was there, and he was outside of India negotiating a disagreement between two Indian families in Durban. And when he was there, he came face to face with the kind of racial prejudice that was going on. It happened. In fact, the opera begins with him picking himself up off the ground, because what had happened, he's just been thrown off a train because though we had a first-class ticket, he was in the white compartments and not in the colored compartments. They threw him off the train. The opera begins with that moment because, in fact, according to Gandhi's own autobiography, at that moment he decided his mission became clear to him, that he had to change things.
And the opera ends with him singing, "I come into being." So this is the period where he becomes the Gandhi that
that's
we
right.
know. And that's what you're dealing with here.
And behind him, one is seeing that, of course, is Martin Luther King. And he, in this new production, which is a beautiful production that Phelan McDermott and Julian Crouch designed and directed this piece. In this production, which you didn't see if you saw it in 81, Gandhi and Martin King actually look at each other.
There's also Tolstoy on the stage.
Tolstoy and Tagore. So, as I said, it's a very ambitious piece. It tries to tie together a lot of things. And one thing I wanted to say about this right away, that what I like so much about having it done now, though it was nobody planned it this way, but for the first time, what's happening in the streets is what's happening in the opera house.
So that I was actually going to ask you that. Is this a particularly relevant time to revive this opera in the light of the protests that have swept the globe, starting with Tunisia last year?
Unfortunately, there's always a good time to do this opera. It's just the way it is. But never has it been so close at hand. I mean, in the city we live in, Leonard, I mean, these things are happening.
What's your position about Occupy Wall Street?
My position is that this is a free speech and free assembly, and this is the basic, this is Bill of Rights stuff. This is what this country's built on. And what these people do by acting in this way, they bring back to us the importance of our basic freedoms.
So this is the time when Gandhi worked out his whole idea.
The strategies of nonviolence.
And Satyagraha roughly translates as truth force.
Yes, that's right. And every technique, whether filling the jails or burning registration cards or marches, it all was developed by Gandhi and tried out in South Africa. He left there in 1913, went back to India, and by 1947, this one little guy, and he even used to say things like that, as long as there is one person telling the truth in the society, things can change. He actually believed that, and it seems to have been true.
Your opera has been called a meditation on Gandhi. You haven't followed a more traditional plot line. In fact, Constance de Jong adapted the libretto from the Bhagavad Gita. Was that a scripture that Gandhi was particularly fond of?
Yeah, he had memorized it. He knew it by heart. And the reason I wanted to do the Bhagavad Gita, because it occurred to me that when someone memorizes a poem or a saying like that, it's very likely that the text could have appeared in his mind at the very time when the actions were taking place. And that I don't doubt, even though there's no way I can know this, I don't doubt that the Bhagavad Gita reverberated in everything he did.
My guest is Philip Glass, whose opera, Satyagraha, is being revived at the Metropolitan Opera, originally staged in
1981.
And then the Met picked it up in 2008.
Well, a new production happened at the English National Opera in 2007, and Peter Gell went over and saw it, and he decided he wanted to bring it. It is the original production. However, he had to rebuild it. The Met is bigger than anything. I mean, it had to be rebuilt for that stage. But Phelim and Julian were the original producers, the directors of it.
Well, the Met is now putting on producing a lot more contemporary opera than it did in the past. It seemed to have resisted in the past. And now we have John Adams and you.
Yes, but in the early 90s, I was part of a commissioning program. I know that John Corleone had an opera and I had an opera. There were other operas being done. But I think Joe Volpe really wanted to do that. What Peter has brought to it, the simulcasts, and this whole new thing, which is it seems to be making opera a popular art form again, which is astonishing, because this is going to be Ensemble Orchestra on the 19th. That means anyone within hearing range of this radio program can actually see it.
On television or in a theater?
In a theater.
Because there are theaters it's being shown,
50,
shown
50
HD all over the world.
50 countries. So what this means is that I don't have to be worried about this opera being not seen. It's definitely going to be seen.
What about understood? How many people speak Sanskrit? The opera is performed in Sanskrit.
Well, it is not so many, but in fact, the texts are projected on the screen. We don't use the
supertitles.
Supertitles, which is one a beautiful part of the program at the Met, but we project it on the scenery itself. So you absolutely, and we even identify the characters. The first opera is named after Tolstoy. The second, first scene Tolstoy, the first act, first Tolstoy, the second act, Tagore, and the third act would be Martin Luther King. And we see them and we see their names.
Now, Tagore is this great poet and wrote some wonderful short stories and novels as well.
He was a companion of Gandhi's, and he encouraged him. And it was Tagore that would be with him when he was going on his fasts and his marches.
In India, he would be considered one of the greatest writers of all time.
Right. That's right.
Largely
that's
unknown
right.
in this country, unless you've seen Satyajit Ray
films.
There's
an exhibit right now at Asia Society of his paintings. By
oh,
him.
Fabulous. You know. But what about Sanskrit? Is singing in Sanskrit difficult?
It's not any more difficult than singing in Italian. In fact, it has many of the same characteristics. A lot of words end in vowels, consonants at the beginning, not at the end, which happens in German and in English, which makes them difficult languages to sing. But when you end a word with a vowel with an open sound, it becomes easier. It's not that hard.
You can hold it longer. You can't hold a n sound
that's
very long.
Exactly. The real difficulty, Leonard, is that is to memorize it. To memorize a language that you don't know is much more difficult. And this chorus and the singers have completely mastered it.
The New York Times called the 2008 staging of Satyagraha, which called it a landmark work of minimalism. And we've discussed your feelings about being categorized as a minimalist in the past. Have you come to accept it by now?
Well, I guess I've come to accept that, but probably in the way that Hitler would have been accepted as being the monster of Western civilization. I mean, that's how I'm known, so what could I say? But on the other hand, I'm very proud of the work, no matter what you call it, and it has features which certainly relate to that. There's a simplicity and directness which has more to do with the story than the style of the music. But it's not out of alignment with an idea of minimalism.
Well, minimalism and Indian music have some links, and the Associated Press said that the repetitions in your score become, I'm quoting, hallucinatory, slowing down and stretching time. It's a little like what Wagner achieved in Parsifal.
And maybe Schubert achieved with his piano sonatas, the late ones. But, you know, this kind of repetition is nothing actually new to us. What's striking about it is how powerful, how a powerful message can be encased in a technique like that, and it makes it travel much better in a certain way.
Well, we mentioned during our previous segment that there's puppetry in this.
Wonderful.
And also the performers make brilliant use of simple materials like newspaper and packing tape.
Yeah.
In one scene, Gandhi disappears into a moving mass of newspaper that looks almost alive.
I know. It's quite astonishing. And besides the singers and the chorus, there's Julian and Phelan brought with them a group they call a skill team. That they're not dancers, but they can dance, but they're movers, and they're people who move around. They move the props. They become the. It's like in the Japanese theater where you have the people in black moving things around, except that you can see these, and they dress our characters. They dress Tagore. They dress King, they fly. So it adds a dimension to the stage, which is quite remarkable.
Has the Satyagraha ever been performed in India or South Africa?
We've been talking about it for 30 years. I think there might be more of a chance in South Africa simply because I think there would be theaters there that could hold it. One of the things is, where would you perform it in India? I don't think their concert hall is quite big enough. But there are all kinds of problems, but we've agreed to continue talking about it. There's part of the Indian community here and there that would love to see this brought home.
And then the New York Philharmonic recently performed your Koyaanisqatsi, yeah, which was a film score, but now has become a work to be performed
we
in its
do
own.
It, do. And another odd thing, Leonard, is that I wrote these two pieces. I wrote Satyagraha first, and then immediately after I wrote I wrote Koyaanisqatsi. Now, this year, we saw Koyaanisqatsi, and immediately after Satyagraha. So these are two pieces that were born almost in the same birthing room, as it were.
And when you look at them, and do you think, oh, gee, that's the way I used to compose, or do you still see links?
Oh, I see definite links. But I'm very curious about the young man that, not that young, I was in my late 30s and early 40s, but I'm very more curious about the man who wrote the pieces than what he would have been like.
You'd be curious about who you were at that time.
Wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, we're always curious about who we were then. When we see things that we did, we might think, gee, what an idiot I was. Or we might think, gee, that was pretty smart. I didn't know I was that smart.
How did I pull that off? When, and in fact, when I did Gandhi, I only did it because I was so absorbed with the life of this man.
Satyagraha. Well, sorry, Philip. Satyagraha at the Metropolitan Opera. Thank you so much.
Okay.